Hello and welcome to the HSJ Health Check podcast. I'm your host, Rebecca Thomas, filling in for the legendary Annabelle Collins, and I'm joined this week by Bureau Chief Lawrence Dunhill and Primary Care Correspondent Jasmine Rapson. This week we're going to be talking about the subject that will be on everybody's mind, the government's latest health and much-awaited social care funding commitments. We'll also be taking a dive into an investigation by Jasmine and HSJ's news manager, Hayley Kirton, which revealed several coroners have raised concerns over patients being assessed remotely in general practice. But first, Lawrence, you've written our headliner this week, a report reporting quite a different figure to the $12 billion being touted by the government. Perhaps you can unpick the figures for us a little.
Yeah, sure. And obviously, our focus here is on the health side of things of what was announced. But I think we should also acknowledge that this announcement was extremely disappointing for the social care sector. The briefings in the run up to Tuesday had suggested that there would be a kind of new vision and sustainable funding package for the sector. But there was no clear plan announced about how the services would be improved, and the NHS again got most of the new funding that was being offered. And there was also nothing to suggest any solution to the major problem facing social care, which is workforce and its ability to attract people into low-paid jobs. But on the health side, in the run-up to the announcement, the big lobby groups, NHS providers and NHS Confed, said that £10 billion would be needed per year for the NHS England budget to avoid service cuts and putting patients at risk, the normal sort of warnings we hear. And the headline announcement that was kind of briefed out and then put in the press release sounded like this had been met, because it was broadly for £30 billion over 3 years in England, so it equates to about £10 billion a year. But when you dig into that, £5 billion of it was for social care, and then £10 billion was for the non-NHS bit of the Department of Health budget, and so that's for kind of COVID costs like test and trace and those other bits, and that leaves about £15 billion for NHS England, which is about, so that's about half the amount that the lobby groups were saying was needed. And that is front loaded a bit, so £6.5 billion next year. And that comes with the expectation of a 30% increase in elective activity by 2025 compared to pre-pandemic levels. That sounds like a hell of an ask when you kind of put it like that, but it's 10% higher than what the NHS was already planning to do by that time. So it's in 4 years' time. That's where they're expecting to be. The lobby groups clearly think the money isn't enough for that to be achieved and to cover all the extra COVID costs that come with infection prevention control and so on. But then you have others like the Institute of Fiscal Studies saying that it should be enough. I think the reality here is that there's just massive uncertainty, both around COVID and what's going to happen with that, and the waiting list, because it's really difficult to predict how much of the so-called pent-up demand is going to come through onto the waiting list. And so perhaps you can forgive the government for not automatically handing out all the funding that was being asked for what they would have seen as a worst case scenario, because they no doubt kind of know that whatever money they give will always be spent, regardless of which scenario pans out. And the lesson from history here is that whatever funding is initially planned for the NHS in spending reviews or budgets inevitably ends up being increased or topped up as they go along. And so the IFS calculated that over the last 30 years, the actual increases to the NHS budget have ended up being 50% higher than what was originally planned. So I think that the government will know that these are very unlikely to be the final budgets, and if it becomes clear that more money is needed to avoid a sort of disaster situation with the waiting lists, then they'll know they can get the checkbook out again down the line. And to some extent, that sounds fair enough. But the frustration on the NHS side is that that means it never sort of has certainty over its budget and can't plan over the long term as it may want to do.
I'm curious. So we'll talk about the frustration on the NHS side. I've seen a few pieces titled this an NHS money grab from social care. And we often, when spending commitments come around, we often talk about social care losing out. Simon Stevens talked a lot about the need for a properly funded social care plan. But how do those in the NHS, do you think, see the social care, kind of the social care losing out from this funding commitment? Are they frustrated by it?
I think, yes, there certainly is frustration and a lot of sympathy for social care sector. I think most NHS leaders would agree that social care is more in need than the NHS in its sort of longer term sustainability. But, you know, equally, the NHS has immediate COVID pressures to meet, and significant pressure, kind of public pressure over its waiting list, which are really getting quite alarming in terms of the long waiters. And so ultimately, you know, that they are accountable to patients and their local populations over what they are responsible for, and they still feel like they're not being given enough money to do what they need. So it only goes so far, that the sympathy for social care, I suppose.
I saw an interesting tweet from Claire Murdoch, who's our NHS England's National Mental Health Director, thanking Chris Ham on the radio for recognising that elective pressures on the NHS include mental health, learning disability and autism services. Obviously, when the announcement came out, a lot of people will be thinking this is this money is to tackle elective care waiting lists. But do we know how much of this funding is likely to cover other sectors yet?
Not yet, because this is only the first stage of the government announcing how much money NHS England would get, and then it's down to NHS England to then allocate the money between different sectors. But certainly with this headline target of a 30% increase in elective activity by 2025, that's obviously going to demand a lot of this funding. And so no doubt mental health primary care leaders are going to be quite nervous about how much of this extra money they are getting to cope with the extra pressures they are facing.
I do wonder whether I'm not sure if you remember, but mental health was awarded $500 million for this year to start to tackle increases in demand. I do wonder if the conversation will be, you've had your lot, we need the rest of this to focus on the elective list. Obviously, Simon Stevens, as we know, was a pretty big advocate for mental health services, but he's gone now. And I don't know what the current leadership thinks about it.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of nervousness, isn't there, about Simon's departure and what the next attitude to mental health will be, especially with all these new pressures on the acute sector.
Definitely. I'm curious, and forgive my ignorance here, but does the funding commitments cover capital spend at all?
No, and so we'll need to wait for the spending review to find out what the kind of long-term capital budgets are to fund the headline program of the 48 new hospitals, which sounds really good, doesn't it? But ultimately, we need to see the capital budget increasing substantially, and only then will we be able to judge kind of the extent to which this government has supported NHS infrastructure.
Yes, as Dave West revealed last week, those 48 new hospitals are perhaps not quite hospitals in reality, but we'll
yes,
see how
but
much
we have to call them new hospitals.
We have to always. I mean, is this funding announcement and correct me if I'm wrong, our government is saying this effectively proved to us, NHS, that you can spend this well and we'll give you more further down the line. Can we be confident there will be?
I suppose that there's always an element of that, isn't there? But I get the impression that it's more just about the uncertainty of how much the NHS is going to need, and so you can understand the temptation for the Treasury to hold back as much of it as it can until it really knows that the money is needed, and then it will release it. Which is that's happened throughout history, as we can tell from the comparing the planned budgets to the eventual budgets in the NHS, which are always a lot more.
It's interesting. Part of the announcement, we noticed covered prevention, integration, and all of the things the NHS is trying to do over the next year with the move towards ICSs, and there was a suggestion that NHS England would set spending budgets for prevention. How likely is it that any of this funding goes towards prevention, do you reckon?
There does seem like that possibility, because when I was breaking down the budget, you had that 10 billion which was for the non-NHS part of the Department of Health budget. And we know that that bit of the Department of Health budget does include prevention and public health. So there is that potential there for some significant funding increases, but that will depend on what else is calling on that money, I suppose, and that will be things like test and trace, which potentially could take up a lot of that money. So wait and see, I suppose.
So watch this space for those pushing the prevention agenda. While we're talking about a funding package which is ultimately designed to help the NHS tackle the effects of the pandemic, Jasmine, I wonder if we could turn towards you, and a way in which general practice has attempted to adapt to the pandemic is remote consultations. And your investigation this week seems to suggest that there has been a safety issue with remote consultations. Perhaps you can tell us a little about it and what you found.
Yeah, so this piece has raised a number of problems, which we'll go into in a bit, but it basically looks at five prevention of future death reports published by a coroner in Manchester following the deaths of people which have been linked to things being missed during telephone appointments. There are a range of cases that have been brought up. Three of them are mental health related. One was a gentleman who fell over in a care home. He broke his femur, but this was initially missed during x-rays at hospital. He went back home and had a telephone appointment with his GP because he was still in a lot of pain, and it just wasn't conveyed to his GP the kind of pain that he was in, and that it could potentially be a femur break that was missed, and as a result this man deteriorated and sadly passed away. Another of the cases was a gentleman who appeared to have been having hallucinations and eventually died by suicide, but he had conversations with his GP alongside his family, and they'd said that they'd struggled to convey exactly the problems he was experiencing to his GP, and really kind of get their GP to understand exactly how much his condition was deteriorating due to the way appointments were being carried out at this particular practice. So there's kind of a lot to think about with these reports. Prevention of future death reports, by the way, are kind of produced by coroners if it's believed that there's been kind of external factor in someone's death, and they're passed on to organisations if they feel like action needs to be taken to kind of make changes as a result of these deaths. So they've kind of highlighted a problem that I guess has always been around when it comes to remote consultations. There's an argument that, you know, even before the pandemic, there was always a concern that issues might be missed during remote consultations. This has, you know, potentially been exacerbated due to the pandemic, because the pressure on GPs has become so significant for a number of reasons. They're they've got e-consults to sift through on a Monday morning, you know, hundreds in some cases, because e-consult has kind of increased the number of people coming to the doctors with issues, or initially did anyway, because people were able to contact their GP at kind of any time of day. They've also got the issue of people that put off going to their GP before, during lockdown, sorry, because they were worried about COVID and have put off, you know, really serious issues. And as a result, there's been an increase in people seeing doctors for those reasons. And then also, you know, the referral backlog as well. So, you know, GP appointments have increased significantly. And I think naturally, because of the situation that we're in, things are going to be missed. So, you know, it's incredibly tragic these reports have come up, but I think it's a conversation that was always going to have to be had as a result of this rapid introduction to remote appointments that we've had over the past 18 months or so. So it's a difficult one, but it's definitely something, you know, a conversation that needs to be happened so that remote appointments can be carried out in the most effective and efficient way possible without excluding people who don't necessarily have access to remote consultations, and making sure everyone gets the best care that they possibly can.
So there was an interesting quote from Professor Maureen Baker, and as you say in your report, these telephone and remote consultations have been used. They were used prior to the pandemic. So I do wonder, is your investigation here, is it highlighting more the current pressures in general practice? When you're under more pressure, you're likely to make more mistakes, and it's harder to spot things. Or perhaps is it highlighting that telephone and remote consultations are perhaps not being used properly?
I think it's a mixture of things, and it's because remote consultations were onboarded so quickly at the start of coronavirus, and it was involuntary in a way because, you know, no one was prepared for it. It was something that had to happen because otherwise people wouldn't have physically been able to see their doctor during lockdown. So we're kind of, you know, the NHS is dealing with the aftermath of introducing something very, very quickly that quite frankly a lot of practices just weren't prepared for and didn't have the workforce for. So, you know, when something is as large scale as remote appointments have been, I think there will always be cases where something's missed, in the same way where during face-to-face appointments things are sometimes missed or can be missed. So but naturally that's going to be exacerbated by the fact that there is just so much more pressure in a way on GPs at the moment, and they're struggling, you know, they're struggling with a lot, they're struggling with more cases and less staff, burnout. So, you know, like I said, it was a conversation I think that was always going to have to be had, and there's going to have to be investigations into kind of all aspects of, you know, face-to-face and remote appointments to kind of understand where things are going wrong in some cases and try and deliver the best service possible. But I guess it's the case when something is kind of sprung on a system that's not ready for it, there are naturally going to be negative side effects to that, and you know, it's unacceptable that people have died as a result of that. So I think there's a balance to be struck with working out who needs to be seen face to face and who can absolutely continue having remote consultations, because I know for a lot of people, myself included, the move to remote consultations has been hugely beneficial, especially for kind of things like small prescriptions that, you know, aren't urgent, you know, not serious or anything like that. And it actually makes things much more easy, and hopefully in some cases for GPs more efficient. But naturally you don't want people, say perhaps elderly people with lots of health conditions, from putting off seeing their GP because they're scared to use remote consultations, or they're worried that they're going to be turned away from a face-to-face appointment. So just sit down, stay quiet and wait until things get really, really bad. So, you know, there's a lot of things that need to be done, communicating to people how they can see their GP, and then it's still okay to go to your GP for a face-to-face appointment if you really think it's beneficial. And I guess, I mean, I know, you know, you might want to talk about this, Rebecca, but it kind of raises the whole conversation around mental health care as well, and how generally that's been impacted by remote consultations as well.
Well, actually, that's a good point. I was going to ask you, Lawrence, about this, because you had an interview with Caroline Donovan recently as a Mental Health Trust Chief Executive, and she touched on the point of how GP remote consultations are impacting the mental health sector.
Yeah, so she leads the Mental Health Trust in Lancashire and South Cumbria, and she was highlighting how they had seen a really steep increase in patients turning up at A&E in crisis, and one of the things she thought was leading to this was the difficulty in getting a face-to-face GP appointment for these patients, and I guess as you can imagine, there was kind of some quite heightened sensitivities around this from other people in the system, and so the local LMC body said this was a really unfair link to make at this time when GPs are completely overrun with work and don't have, perhaps it's fair to say, they don't have much other option other than to see a lot of people through virtual appointments. Interestingly, then Tracy Vell, who leads the primary care sector in Greater Manchester, commented on the story and said that she said they had done some research into the link between the reduction of face-to-face appointments and poor care, and found there wasn't a link. I've asked her for this research so that we can have a look at it. And that may have been in response to these inquests in Greater Manchester.
It's interesting. I do have some sympathy for the GPs there. I don't know about yourself, Jasmine's primary care reporter, but prior to the pandemic, even I hear a lot of GPs vent frustration about the mental health service support around them. So them having to deal with a complex group of patients that they perhaps shouldn't have the main responsibility for. I mean, do you talk to GPs about the? Have you talked to many GPs about increases in mental health patients they're seeing, and whether it's actually fair for that burden to be on general practice?
I haven't spoken about this issue a lot, kind of specifically, but it's kind of one of those things. I think I wrote a story not too long ago about, you know, how a couple of suicides were missed because I think they were on repeat prescription, and in one case he was a young guy, he hadn't been taking his medication, and the system hadn't either informed the GP that this young man hadn't been taking his medication, this young man hadn't received any reminders to go and get a repeat prescription, and I guess that's one of the parts where I guess the GP computer system itself may be falling short slightly, because GPs aren't kind of, you know, necessarily kept in the loop as to whether their patients that are on repeat prescriptions are collecting their medication. And like you said, Rebecca, I guess it puts, you know, added pressure or worry on GPs that they might miss something, because if their systems, you know, aren't there reminding them of things, they don't have time to kind of individually check up on patients to make sure they're continuing to take their medication until suddenly they hear, you know, they get an awful phone call when it's too late that someone has sadly passed away. And so, I mean, there's just so much to talk about, I guess, on this issue, and I don't know if it's the right time to kind of go into the complexities of GP computer systems and how that they're not necessarily fit for purpose in that kind of area. But yeah, it's another added pressure to put on GPs what is a very, very difficult time for them. And I can completely understand why they're frustrated by the fact that there's, you know, a lot of reports out there by, you know, they're not carrying out enough face-to-face consultations, when at the end of the day, you know, 18 months ago they were told they couldn't do anything apart from remote consultations. Then, you know, a year later they're told by NHS England that they need to go back to face-to-face consultations, and the GPs, and they just felt like they weren't ready for it. It wasn't the right time. They had too much work to do it effectively. So they have, you know, been very vocal about, you know, why it's not necessarily right for them to go back to complete complete face-to-face consultations. But yeah, like I said earlier, there's a balance to be struck, and it does feel like it's all over the place at the moment, and it's a very, very pressured time for all.
Thank you. Sadly, we've come to the end of our time this week. I'm sure we could continue talking about this subject for another hour if we could, but perhaps for a future podcast. Thank you very much, Lawrence and Jasmine, for joining us today. You've been listening to the HSJ Health Check podcast. Just a reminder, it's available each week on the HSJ website and across all main podcast channels. Please don't forget to subscribe if you haven't already. Thank you for listening, and we'll be back next week.